Hey, good morning. Welcome to our workshop on an abundance of broccolini. I will just ask that if you have your cell phones with you, please silence them. Also, if you happen to hear any quiet talking in the room, sometimes there are interpreters with people, so just please be knowledgeable of that. There are handouts in the back of the room if you didn't get them, and a CEU sign-up sheet as well. We are out of the paper conference evaluations, but when you walk out the doors, there are QR codes on the exit doors today that you can scan to do your evaluations with. The bookstore will be closing at 3 p.m. today, so if you want to get to the bookstore before the end of the day, you'll want to stop there before 3 p.m. And the exhibit hall, they said, does start to tear down around then as well. So if you're planning to, you know, visit that before the end of the day today, too, you might want to do that before 3. So enjoy the conference, and I will let the speakers introduce themselves.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Hoidel. I work with University of Minnesota Extension as vegetable crops educator.
And I'm Christine Lang. I'm an assistant professor and consumer horticulture specialist at South Dakota State in Brookings, which is nowhere near the Black Hills, if anyone needed a mental map. We're on the eastern side of the state.
And our other presenter today was going to be Anna Racer from Waxwing Farm. And Anna wasn't able to make it today due to the snowstorm, but we're going to try to fill in some of her content. And like we're a small group, this can be fairly informal. We have some discussion time built in, but feel free to jump in and stop us anytime as we're going along here. So we wanted to start out and just say, why are we spending a whole 90 minutes talking about broccoli? And basically, broccoli is a really important part of our food system. Farmers with CSAs and farmers markets tell us, like, people really expect and want broccoli. I've been doing interviews with farm-to-school directors in Minnesota, and consistently, like, kids want broccoli. I think we have this idea from our grandparents that broccoli is, like, mushy and gross, and, like, kids don't want to eat it. But it's not true. People really love broccoli. And it is inherently hard to grow, and it's becoming harder and harder to grow with climate change. And so that's why we're going to spend 90 minutes talking about it. Mm-hmm.
In addition to the fact that I bugged Natalie and was like, hey, I know you're doing a lot of cool broccoli trials, and we did a broccoli trial in South Dakota. Can we talk about it? And I would echo what Natalie's saying. We're seeing the same thing. One of the biggest frustrations we're seeing in South Dakota after two hot, dry years, we've had parts of the state in like D3, D4 drought. Early season broccoli production has been a no-go for a lot of growers. And so fall broccoli production, and we too are working on, you know, expanding farm-to-school market opportunities in the state. And I think there is an incredible opportunity to improve those linkages with schools.
All right, so just to give you an outline of what we're going to do today, we're going to start out with just an overview of talking about broccoli and some of the challenges that we are seeing and expect to see over the next few decades. I'm going to spend some time talking about our broccoli variety trials that we've been doing in Minnesota. We're going to have a discussion about broccolini and whether broccolini can solve some of our broccoli problems. And then Christine's going to end talking about some really cool living mulch trials she's been doing. So how can we incorporate soil health into vegetable systems in general, but specifically in this case with broccoli. So we're going to get really nerdy for a minute here and talk about broccoli physiology and why broccoli is so unique. And this is true of all of the head-forming brassicas. So broccoli and, in general, this species comes from the Mediterranean. It actually came from this wild mustard plant, Brassica oleraceae. And so farmers, probably in Sicily, around 600 BC, started to select from this plant. So some farmers were selecting for really thick stems, and that became like kohlrabi. Some of them were selecting for flowers, that became broccoli and cauliflower. Some were selecting for leaves. So all of these brassicas that we know today in this species group are actually the same species. It's just been selected for different tissue allocation, basically. And so what's really important about this is that this species is a biennial. So if you are a farmer on a Greek island, you would plant broccoli in the summer. It would put on leafy vegetation, and then it would experience winter. So it has to experience this cold winter in order to trigger head formation. When we grow out here, obviously we don't grow broccoli that way, right? But we're relying on cold nighttime temperatures to create that winter effect that allows broccoli to form a head. And so that's really important as we're thinking about climate change and our nights getting warmer, is our ability to have that winter is shifting a little bit. And so that shift that happens is a distinct shift. So the plant goes from vegetative to reproductive. And there are two factors that cause it. So one, the plant has to have a minimum amount of leaf tissue so that it can produce enough energy for itself. And then it has to have this cold treatment. And the tricky thing is there's not like a perfect recipe. It's not like, oh, it needs six leaves and then this number of cold nights. It's really different for every variety. And some varieties have been bred to need less and to need more. And so there are a lot of things that can go wrong in this process. So one thing that happens is that the head can form when the plant is too small. So physiologically, like, it's big enough that it'll produce a head, but it can't produce enough energy, and so we get these tiny, funky heads. And often we call that buttoning up. Sometimes, it sounds like some of you experienced this fall, head formation is delayed. So we had broccoli trials on like 88 farms this summer. And we had really warm nights, and so that vernalization process wasn't happening. And so it was like November, and people still didn't have a head yet. And so we can get these beautiful leafy broccoli plants that just don't form heads in time for a freeze to come. And then the other thing that can happen is once that shift happens and it's in the head formation phase, the ultimate part of that is that it flowers. And so if there's too much heat that happens as it's forming its head, that process is accelerated and we get bolting. So how many of you have had at least one of these problems? How many of you have had all of these problems? Yeah. So this is what makes broccoli so unique and so tricky to grow. And the bad news is, and I promise we're going to have some good news too, but the bad news to set this up is that the ways that our climate is changing is exacerbating some of these problems. So the first thing, and I do have maps for Wisconsin too. The first thing is that our climate is getting warmer in the upper Midwest. So if we look at the period from 1981 to 2010, and then compare that to projections for mid-century, so 2040 to 2060, we're looking at about twice as many days over 90 degrees, and 3 to 4 times as many nights above 70 degrees. So that nighttime temperature is going up, which can sometimes be more significant than daytime temperatures. The same is true in Wisconsin. These graphs look less dramatic because they use a different color scale, but it's like the exact same set of projections, pretty much. So what does that mean? So it means that we can have issues with head formation in the fall. We're not getting those vernalizing temperatures. And a lot of, like, broccoli just gets ugly when it's heat stressed. We see a lot of weird issues. We see just lumpy heads that aren't compact in the way that we want them to be. They're tiny. What is that? Yeah, little heads. We have really uneven beads and brown bead. We also see a lot more hollow stem. It's a really complicated disorder, but it is in part exacerbated by hot temperatures. And that might not look like it matters that much, but it really reduces the storage life of broccoli. So we have all these things that can happen when it's too hot. The other thing that we're looking at by mid-century is changes in our precipitation patterns. And so in the winter, spring, and fall, we are looking at more precipitation, so about 5 to 15% more, depending on where you're at. But in the summer, we are actually looking at less precipitation, unless you're along Lake Superior. And that is pretty much true for Wisconsin as well. And so what that means is, one, it means more heat stress in the summer. So when we have the same amount of moisture or less moisture and more heat, those heat-related issues become more extreme. But we're also looking at like wetter springs and wetter falls, which can be linked to more disease. So way back in 2019, when this project started, I had just started in this position as an extension educator, and I was traveling all around Minnesota asking farmers, like, what are your priorities? What do you want extension to do? And everybody said, please work on black rot. That is like our number one issue. We had people losing 100% of their fields to black rot. And so we wrote this grant to do this big variety screening project to see if we could identify varietal resistance or tolerance to black rot. And what was kind of weird was that in the years between writing the grant and actually getting the funds, there was this shift in pathogen ecology that happened where all of a sudden, like alternaria was the new disease. And there's still some black rot, but alternaria became almost a bigger issue. And so I'm gonna talk a little bit about these diseases and then talk about some of the results. And that's some of the good news, is that we're finding varieties that can handle all of these changes. So black rot is a bacterial pathogen. It's called Xanthomonas campestris. It moves through water. And so in those years, 2018, 2019, where there was just so much water, it was really easy for this disease to spread. And I think at that time, seed companies were also not testing for it as much. So we don't know all of the details, but I think in some cases it did come in uninfected seed. And since then, seed companies have become really, really vigilant about testing. Again, we are seeing 80 to 100% yield losses on organic farms, and this was like everyone's number one priority. So black rot is really distinct looking. If you ever walk out into a field of broccoli in the morning, you'll see little perfect dew drops on the edges of leaves. So those are from cells called hydrothodes. And so overnight, the broccoli is like pushing excess moisture out. And then in the morning, when it starts to get hot, it pulls it back in. And so you get the bacteria on those little droplets, and then the plant pulls it back in, and it moves through the xylem of the plant. So that's like the veins of the plant. And so that's why you get those V-shaped lesions, because you have this pulling effect of the bacteria into the leaves. So because it's a vascular disease, it spreads through the tissue of the plant, and it spreads really, really fast. It's not like one lesion here or there. It gets into the plant, and basically the whole head just like turns to mush. It's really smelly. It's really nasty. If you've ever been in a field of broccoli with black rot, you know exactly what smell I'm talking about. It can be spread by just like us moving through fields. So like not moving through your field when it's wet is really important. We're learning that it can be spread by insects. So often flea beetle management in the spring is super important because they get it in their saliva. And it's often worse in late season planting. So we see it kind of build up through the summer and it's really bad in the fall. Alternaria is a little bit different. So this is the pathogen that's becoming more prevalent and that for the last couple of years at least, we've seen a lot more of in farms. It's a little different because it's a fungus, not a bacteria. And so we have these kind of distinct lesions on the plant and then the spores are spread through the wind, sometimes water, equipment. We've been trying to understand some of the ecology of this pathogen. There are like four different alternaria species. So far, we've only identified one in Minnesota and Wisconsin. That's what it looks like under a microscope, if anyone's curious. And I know this is an organic farming conference. Some of the species of alternaria do have fungicide resistance, specifically to group 11 fungicides, but not this one that we're seeing in the upper Midwest. So this also is really distinct looking. How many of you have seen this in your plants? A few. So we have these really like concentric rings. That's what makes it really distinct and easy to identify. Alternaria is the same genus that causes early blight. So you've probably seen rings like this in your tomatoes and your peppers. It's a different species, but it has that same pattern. In the head, it looks more like this. So black rot is like the whole head just kind of melts, whereas this is like one little spot. And it's really frustrating because the head can look perfect, but you have this little spot, and it really decreases the shelf life. And not like a wholesale buyer is never going to buy it. It persists in residues. It does well in high humidity. And so these pathogens were really, really devastating on organic farms. We didn't have good management options. But there was some promising research in cabbage where growers were finding resistant varieties. So we decided, let's screen broccoli and see if we can find varieties that are resistant to some of these issues. And so that's what we did. We worked with the Fruit and Vegetable Growers Association in Minnesota, and we seed-linked. Nico's right here, so Nico coordinated part of this trial. And our goals, again, were to identify broccoli that could withstand these diseases. And also, it kind of turned into like a heat stress trial, too. We did this broccoli disease study in two really extreme drought years. And so it also became just like a drought trial. And we're really excited about the way that we did this trial. So we had 86 farmers and gardeners doing trials in 2021, and then 80 more in 2022. So we had all of these growers testing these varieties to give us feedback. One of the things growers often tell us is like, you can do something on a research station, but like, I don't know if it's gonna work on my farm. So we got to have all these farmers weigh in and tell us what they thought, in addition to a research station trial. And so at the research station, we actually were able to inoculate it. So we got black rot, the bacteria, and we spread it all over the field. We infected all of the plants. And then we used terrible sanitation. So we did everything you should never do. We overhead irrigated every day in the morning. We walked through the fields, spread it around. And so that's the beauty of university research, is you can do things that you would never do on a farm and take risks that we would never ask farmers to take on. So that was our plot in Waseca. We did 17 varieties for an early planting and 17 varieties for a late planting each year. And we tried to source kind of a mix of things, so grower favorites that already existed that could be kind of like checkpoints. We worked with breeders who had varieties that are not yet out, but they thought were promising. And then we tried to get broccoli from all over the world. So we had broccoli from Italy. There was some broccoli from Israel. What am I missing? Basically, broccoli from all over. We had some land races trying to like really get as much genetic diversity as we could. And then this is the map of growers. So mostly Minnesota and Wisconsin, but a few people from elsewhere. And about like a third to a half of the people participating actually submitted reviews of the varieties they grew. So the farmers had a much simpler process. They all tested like four varieties and then ranked them using a simple ranking system. And so I'm not gonna go through the whole trial, but you all have the report in front of you if you wanna really dig into it. I'm just gonna share a couple highlights. So in 2021, even like despite our best efforts to create like terrible disease pressure, we didn't do that good of a job. It was really dry. We didn't get as much disease pressure as we wanted. And so in 2021, the growers and then at the research station, those results were like almost identical. We found some varieties that people really liked that did well in all the different environments. But in 2022, we were able to really get a lot of disease pressure built up. And then things started to diverge. And so there were varieties that growers really liked that just couldn't stand up to that level of disease. So that's something you'll notice as you look through this 2022 report, is the grower responses are different from the research station responses, and that's why there was just so much more disease pressure. So for summer, the varieties that we ended up recommending were Wolfman, Green Magic, and Eastern Crown. So those were varieties that the growers really liked and did well in our disease trial. And of those, Eastern Crown had the best. Thompson, Monty, and Jacaranda all had great disease tolerance in that trial, but they couldn't handle the heat. Yeah. It is. So the question was, are those certified organic? And it sounds like Green Magic, you can get certified organic. And the others, you can get untreated. So everything we used in this trial was untreated seed. And often, like, if you have a reason to use one variety, it's not certified. As long as it's untreated, your certifier will approve it. They should approve it. Yeah, so Nico's comment was, like, you could use this survey, or you could use this trial, show it to your certifier and say, I need to use this variety because it did better, even if it's not certified. Does anyone have experience with these three? Green Magic is the best? Okay. Anyone disagree? Okay, people like Green Magic. Yeah.
They're similar names, and some of these varieties did really well at Dr. Horton's heat counts.
Yes.
So those two together are very, very valuable.
Yeah, so thank you for saying that. So there's a network of people like doing really similar research. So Cornell, University of Georgia, New Jersey, they're all doing broccoli trials. And so we have these cross-reference points. These are pictures of them. So I think of all of them, you have a chart showing all the different characteristics. So the head size, bead uniformity, bead color, et cetera. Eastern Magic, or Eastern Crown, was the biggest. It was, I think, almost twice as big, each head, as the other two. And Eastern Crown, I think, was developed by Cornell specifically to be able to handle warm nights. So those were our spring recommendations. And the fall is where like everything fell apart disease-wise. So we were growing the broccoli in the same field as last year, still inoculating, still using terrible sanitation. So we may have had disease conditions that were like worse than you would realistically have on a farm. But in the worst case scenario, Bellstar, which again is like a common variety that a lot of people grow, did amazingly well. 98% of the heads had no disease symptoms, despite everything around it, like, crumbling. And so Bellstar was really the only one that we felt really good about recommending. It did not do well in the spring. It couldn't handle the heat stress of spring. I thought this was maybe... Covina was really interesting. So Covina also had, I think, like 97% of the heads with no disease. But so many of them had black rot in the stem, in a way that none of the other varieties did. And so that's kind of interesting. Like, that could be a resistance mechanism. Like, it's able to stop it from spreading. But it was so much worse than other varieties that we're, like, not super confident recommending that. Some other ones, so growers really liked Eastern Crown, Diplomat, Imperial, and Abrams. They had okay disease tolerance, but, like, really not as good. And then last year, we loved Asteroid, Luna, and Monty. We were so excited about Luna and Monty, and growers loved them. People wanted to grow them again, and they just didn't do very well this year. So those are some pictures of Bellstar and Covina. Covina, I think especially in the spring, had kind of lumpy heads in addition to being disease tolerant. Does anyone have any thoughts about Bellstar? I feel like some people love it and some people hate it, and some people are disappointed that that was the disease-resistant one. Okay. So it's doing well in southern Iowa?
It worked well in the spring for us, but not in the fall.
Interesting.
So just 1 year.
Yeah. So it did well in the spring, but not the fall. And in our case, it was the opposite.
But we're down in Indiana. I don't know.
Okay, in Indiana. All right, so that's all I'm gonna say about varieties, but you have a whole packet, and I'm happy to talk more. And since we're talking about these two diseases, I just wanted to say a little bit more again, both of these diseases are influenced by water. And so varietal resistance is a really important tool, but it's not the only tool. The growers that I know who have successfully pivoted from having a lot of black rot to being able to manage it have really, really changed their practices. So they've switched to drip irrigation. They have often like added a little bit more spacing between broccoli. And the big thing that they've done is created kind of this mental shift in how they move through their fields. So really training employees, like often there's only one person who works in the brassicas. You start your day, like we all have our farm clothes that are dirty and muddy. You start your day with clean clothes and clean shoes in the healthiest, youngest plants, and you move towards the oldest plants. And if you're in a field with disease, you're done. You don't go back. So those are like basic sanitation practices, but it's easy to preach about them and a lot less easy to do them. But making those shifts is really what has made a difference for organic growers who have dealt with these diseases. And so, as a final thing, since we're talking about all of the broccoli problems, I wanted to just wrap up with some insect updates. So the kind of good news about broccoli is we have these five insect pests, and some of them are difficult to manage, but they are consistent. They show up every year. We can expect them to be here, and we have tools to manage them. And so I'm not actually going to talk really about these today. If anyone wants to talk one-on-one about a management plan for any of these, happy to do that. But we have really consistent insect issues in broccoli. The new insect that we should all be aware of is Swede midge. Does anyone have Swede midge already? Okay, you've got it in Indiana. Okay, so Swede midge is, it's here, but what's really weird about it is it only seems to be in community gardens and urban areas. So it's in the Twin Cities, it's in Milwaukee, it's in Madison, but we're not yet seeing it on farms, which is weird because on the East Coast it is on farms. We don't know why that shift hasn't happened. And the main thing is like, you should know about it. You don't have to freak out about it you just should know that it exists and kind of be ready to detect it if you do see it. So it's this tiny, tiny midge. It's about 2 millimeters, and so often you don't actually see it. You see the damage, and the damage is that it causes distorted tissues. So sometimes you see this like quirkiness. Sometimes you see like flower tissue coming out of a stem. Sometimes you just see really like curly leaves, almost in a way that looks like herbicide damage. I'm echoing. And so at this point, the recommendation is like just kind of know what it looks like, and if you suspect it, reach out to your extension person or reach out to your State Department of Ag so that they know it's out there, and then we can start to talk about management. But right now it's like it's not worth spending a lot of energy managing, and a lot of the same tools that you use for all of these other insects, so row cover, crop rotation, certain organic insecticides are going to be the same tools that you might use for this new insect. And so with that, I think we're going to take a few minutes.
Yeah. Can you go back to the slide?
This one? So that's the website for that is right there. And yeah, it's a nice little visual guide. A student at Carleton College illustrated all these insects for us. So let's take like 2 minutes and maybe just like turn to the person next to you, if you have someone next to you, and share like, are any of these varieties things you might be excited to try? Do you feel like optimistic about varieties as a response to some of these changes right now? pterodactyls have like their
I think so. I think a cool question to ask might be people like historically on their farm, has black rot been the issue or alternaria? Because I'm just curious, show of hands.
Yeah.
Because I just, when I sit in farm conversations with like Iowa farmers, it's always like they're like terrified of black rot. Mm-hmm. It's just fascinating. I kind of have a cover crop tie-in for that too that we can touch on.
Okay, this is your like 40-second warning.
Natalie, this is my graduate student Alexis.
Hi, nice to meet you. What are you working on the broccoli living mulch stuff?
Yep. Yeah. That's great.
Are you gonna get up and talk about it all?
If we have any clarifying questions, I might. I feel like it's getting a little quieter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Does anyone want to share any thoughts from your quick conversation? Anything that stood out?
Where can we get these newfangled varieties that are doing well? Because I tend to order 90% of my seeds, brassicas at least, for Johnny's and high mowing.
Okay. Yeah, good question. So the question is, where can we find these varieties? Scott gets a lot of his varieties from Johnny's at High Mowing and hasn't seen some of these. So those are like good starting places to check out. I think Johnny's has a lot of these. Seedway was the place where we were able to find almost all of them. Seedway has those? Oh, Harris. Yeah, Harris was another place we got a lot of broccoli. Osborne. I think those were probably the main three. Seedway, Harris, and Osborne. If you look at those plus Johnny's, you should find everything. Or, just type the variety name into Google, I guess. These are all commercially available. Before we move on, does anyone have any questions? Anything you're still struggling with? Yeah. Good question. So, if you have a field full of crop residue that's diseased, what do you do with it? Often, I know many of us are thinking about soil health and reducing tillage. Often the best thing you can do is chop it up, if you have a flail mower and incorporate it and just let it break down, and the faster it breaks down, the better. I think it depends on your scale. You could remove some residue and burn it somewhere. I think that might be labor prohibitive. So I think the main thing is incorporate it really well, and then really stick to a 3 to 4 year rotation. Do a 4 year rotation if you have really bad disease pressure. And I think a lot of small farms struggle to have really good rotations from a disease perspective. You might be rotating a lot, but you've got some broccoli over here and over there and some kale here and some collards there. And as much as you can think about keeping families of crops together in distinct areas, I know that that's not always feasible, but it becomes really important as you start to build up disease pressure.
Yeah.
So you guys talked a lot about heat stress and zero rush, planting and growing broccolini inside
So the question is, like, we're talking about heat stress. They're interested in growing broccolini in a hoop house. Is that a bad idea? I don't know if I... So the thing about broccolini, and we're about to talk about it, is, like, it can flower and it's fine. Does anyone else grow broccoli in a hoop house? Yeah, Liz?
Broccolini.
Okay.
Yeah, broccolini.
You do grow broccolini in a hoop house. And it flowers sometimes and it's fine, or do you not have bolting issues in your hoop house? So you're growing it really in the shoulder seasons. Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't try to grow it in the middle of summer in a hoop house. But there are a lot of people that grow broccoli like on the outer edges of their tunnels really early in the season, and it's fine. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a risk. I would plant a little bit and see how it goes, maybe. Does anyone else have experience you want to share?
I think the big benefit of that is that you're limiting your only groundwatering or drip take most of the time in your hoop house. So you're just completely reducing the spread of disease by water when you do that. And so if you figure out ventilation,
do we want to start using this?
Yeah, maybe we should.
I know a lot of people don't put fans in hoop houses or any electronics in there, but I think there's a way you can get extra ventilation and cool it down a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a trade-off between less disease pressure and hotter nights. And that is I think among extension vegetable people, one of our great missions is to get people to put fans and gable vents in high tunnels. There are so many tunnels that don't have that vent, and it is so important for getting hot air out.
More important than shading, but yeah, we can talk about high tunnel shading research another day.
I just wanted to speak to the organic question. The without getting too far down a rabbit hole here, there's one element to brassica breeding that has been a moratorium in the organic world, and that has to do with the way the females self with one another. And so the process by which companies, breeders, have been able to produce that seed has not been allowed in organic production. That just recently changed, and so companies are going to have breeders and companies that sell seed are going to have some decisions to make about whether they want to push some of these varieties that are these hybrids in particular that are really good for some of these characteristics into organic production, and then companies are going to need to decide whether they want to sell them, and that's going to take some time. But that's why we're not seeing, many of these really high performers in the organic world. So it's one of those places where you should really be talking to your certifier up front about the decision, the decisions that you're making, because clearly, if you want marketable broccoli more than one season in a year or from year to year, you really are looking at some of these high flyers that are not going to be available organically for quite some time.
Hey, thanks for sharing that. Why don't we keep going? We're going to have a little discussion about broccolini. And Anna was supposed to be presenting this, so I'm going to do my best to channel Anna here. So we just talked about all these problems that broccoli has and all the ways that it can go wrong. And so broccolini is something that may be a solution, not for everybody, but for some people. So broccolini is, again, same species, but instead of forming that one distinct head, it forms more like shoots with little florets on top. And it seems to have less of that determinate habit where you go from vegetative to reproductive and that's it. It kind of keeps producing shoots and keeps flowering. And so think of a determinate versus an indeterminate tomato, kind of that same concept. And so there are a lot of growers who are starting to shift to just growing broccolini instead. They don't want to deal with the stress of broccoli. And so Anna was going to talk about her experiences with it, and we can't really do that justice, but we can share some pictures. They've been growing it for their CSA. They've been growing purple varieties, green varieties. People really seem to love it. They also do a lot of restaurant sales, and restaurants have been really enthusiastic to buy broccolini. And I'll just say, like myself, like when I go to the co-ops in the Twin Cities, they're often selling broccolini for like $5 a bunch, and it's always from California. And so this is anecdotal, but it seems like there's some opportunity there. One kind of cool side benefit is that it does flower, and people seem to be okay with it. Like, flowering in broccoli is not acceptable, but flowering in broccolini is cute. So that's just like what we've decided. And so like the bolting isn't as much of a deal. And also you get some pollinator benefits. So Anna had a bunch of pictures of pollinators hanging out in the broccolini. Yeah.
In 2021, Rachel keeps bees at our farm. And so it was super dry in the fall, and we had a bed of broccolini kind of off on the edges that we let go to seed, or you know, we were done picking it, and she says, oh, leave it. And it was covered in bees. It actually was really beneficial at that point. And we didn't this year, and it was a noticeable difference at a time of year when there is often not a lot for the bees to feed on.
Awesome. Yeah, nice. Liz, if it's okay, I might put you on the spot. Oh, she can't hear. So, Liz, you were like nodding enthusiastically.
Sorry. We want to capture the enthusiasm.
Do you just? It sounds like you're growing a lot of broccoli.
I grow a lot of broccoli.
Anything about it?
I grow it both in the spring and the fall. It sells almost better than broccoli at my farmer's market.
So you haven't fully switched. You're still growing broccoli.
Still grow broccoli. It's very hot. I'm from Missouri, so I have really only grown broccoli in the fall. I don't try it in the spring. But broccolini, both spring and fall, it does great. It's faster. and my grocery stores buy it. They love it. My CSA members love it. Farmers Market loves it.
So thanks for sharing. Sorry to put you on the spot.
No worries. Liz, how does the yield compare, like, for the same space as compared to broccoli?
You can cut it so many times. I mean, yield, I don't know if I would say it by weight, but it is much more productive than just a head of broccoli because you're getting so many cuts off of one plant.
Liz, how many cuts are you getting?
Oh, my, I couldn't even tell you. I harvest it for 4 weeks, 5 weeks.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, so many.
So Abby, to that question, I was also just going to quick share this slide. So we had an undergrad student.
B6-1611.
So Lizbeth did this trial last summer. It was just kind of a quick variety trial, but they got about 3,500 pounds per acre. In our broccoli trials, we were getting more like 8,000 pounds of acre. Of broccoli, but again, those were like two really different systems. This was more limited input, so that's, I wouldn't treat that as a direct comparison, but that's one point that at the student organic farm on the Twin Cities St. Paul campus, that was about what they were getting, and they were selling it to restaurants for about $2.75 a pound. Yeah.
That you might want to take into consideration. In fall, we've previously done Happy Rich and BC1611, which were great, but they're not very cold tolerant. If you're going to get a cold snap, it does them in. We did Melody in our tunnels this fall, and we had extra row cover inside, and it survived amazingly temperatures that the other ones would have never got through. Even we did Noble Jade the previous year, which Melody outperformed that as far as cold tolerance. And we sell half-pound bunches for, what did we do, $4.50 or $5. So that's a really good, it's good that way too. And people love it once you tell them, you don't have to chop this head up or peel the stems. You can just take that bunch laid on your cutting board and chop, chop, chop in 3/4, 1-inch pieces, throw it in a stir fry, or we have a vendor at our market who makes wraps and bowls, and she does it all the time like that.
So, thank you. It's good feedback. Did you want to share something?
How does the labor compare for in terms of harvesting broccoli versus broccolini for you?
I think broccolini's fast. I mean, broccoli is fast to harvest too. We bunch it. I mean, we're bunching broccolini, and it's fast. You just whip right through there, whack, 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 make a bunch, whack, whack, whack. It just is not. I mean, broccoli is fast to harvest also. I don't know. It's like kale.
I would say it's kind of a spectrum. Like, broccolini's over here, and broccoli's here, but even, like, a lot of the broccolis are producing side shoots. And,
yeah.
Like, depending on the variety you choose, you're going to be, you know, either going through and doing one clean harvest or going back consistently. So,
yeah.
Yeah, Nico.
Yeah, great discussion. With seedling trees, it's highly likely we're going to have a trial happening this year. So if you're interested, just we will post it probably soon, but just watch out on seedling website and we'll just sign up and we can reach back to you.
Is that a broccolini trial, Nico?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
cool.
With different seed partner. But.
So
Seedlinked.com. Seedlinked, ed@the end.com is a platform used for collaborative trialing with a grower. We use for the broccoli and many other trial. Yeah, you can all the time check on the website, look at collaborative trial. We partner with many different breeder seed company. Also, all the data is connected on the platform, so you can see aggregated data from many different trial, not only one, but many broccoli trial all connecting together. So you can go on seedling looking for broccoli, and you will see all the data from all the grower, make decision, and also see where you can find them.
Natalie and Nico, for that SeedLink website, do you go specifically and look for University of Minnesota trials, or how do growers find you to connect with your trials?
Natalie, you can find the result also on your website, the extension of University.
We've got the report on our website,
yeah.
But then you also have some of the interactive graphs that growers submitted.
Okay. Yeah, so SeedLink is a new platform, and it's evolving with you, with all your feedback from grower to seed company, and you make this happen. And so all those questions you're asking like right now, it's very great insights as we are. So on SeedLink, you will see agglomerated data. You can also contact us. We can send you specific data from specific trial. In the future, you will be able to search for specific trials. So we're building this, so that's coming. Thanks for validating where it's heading. but any feedback, just feel free to reach out to us. It's a very dynamic team, and it's a platform that evolved very quickly, thanks to all of you. So it's just bring the collective power of all of you to inform all of us, and from breeder to grower, so yeah.
So let's move on.
All right. We're gonna pass the clicker. And again, just wanted to thank you for expanding on how people can engage with the trials a little bit more. I'd be remiss in Wisconsin if we didn't also give a nod to the Seed to Kitchen Collaborative and their trial work. So for folks who are looking for, you know, other seed sources and other trial results, that's a really great place to look. Again, for folks who walked into the room a little late, I'm Christine Lang. I hail currently from Brookings, South Dakota. I've been an assistant professor and extension specialist there for 2 years, and I collaborate very closely with my colleague, Dr. Rhoda Burrows, on vegetable and cut flower research. My graduate student, Alexis, is here in the front row, so I like to start with acknowledgments because nothing we did this summer would have been possible without these lovely humans. That is the wrong direction. All right. So my goal is to talk about one tiny slice of the broccoli research component. We have ongoing work looking at reducing tillage, and I know how many folks were in the tillage reduction session yesterday. Okay, well, this isn't going to be a repeat for many people. That's awesome. So there's a lot of us that are, you know, interested in how can we reduce tillage on our farms. As I traveled South Dakota, both listening to community gardeners and master gardeners and small-scale food producers, the same questions were like, we're really interested in cover crops, we don't know what to use, we're sick of throwing plastic away. You have all probably been in similar situations, and we know how important cover crops are for rotations on organic farms. So you know these benefits. We know why we try to get cover crops in rotations. One thing I want to point out for folks, if you're using diverse cover crop mixes, especially for any beginning farmers in the room, if you're thinking through your rotations, I was recently in a meeting where it's a certified organic farm, and we're going to be, it was a group discussion about putting that farm into cover crops and doing some intensive weed management, and the vegetable farmer in the room raised their hand and they're like, okay, if you want to use a diverse cover crop mix, that's great, but we need to get all of those brassicas out if we intend this. It's a farm that's going to be kind of going through some land transition steps. If we want to be forward thinking for vegetable farmers, we need to remove those brassicas from the mix. So in terms of disease management, especially for black rot, make sure you're not leaning into those oilseed radishes and yellow mustards that are great in rotations or for their biofumigation properties in a lot of contexts, but not if you're doing brassicas. So I just wanted to call that out right away. So we know cover crops have all these wonderful benefits. So how can we leverage cover crops in these intensive systems, like the work that UW, so we've got Rue and Julie and Aaron Silva and Claire and Dylan are doing wonderful, wonderful work. I wanted to take that frame of mind and how can we look at a system in South Dakota where we're typically getting less rainfall and dealing with our own challenges. As you get further west in South Dakota, you cross the Mississippi, you cross the Missouri River, we get into short grass prairie country, we have significantly reduced rainfalls. Can we use these cover crops as living mulch in our system, start to reduce plastic inputs? What does that look like? If you're like, what in the world is a living mulch? There's some wonderful resources, and Natalie and I do have our PowerPoint attached in the Marble Seed app too, so you can already download that, but feel free to snap a picture if you wanna do some deep dives. But goals of using cover crops as a living mulch, so having a pure stand of cover crops in, you know, living mulch in its pure form would be, you know, no exposed soil, pure stands of cover crops, no need for plastic mulch. Can we get rid of plastic mulch? Weed suppression, support for pollinators with some of these blooming cover crops in these systems. But a lot of the research has shown, positive benefits in the ability to reduce plastic mulch, suppress weeds, and support pollinators. And there's a new paper that just came out by the UW team, so I want to call that one out first, by Dylan and Aaron Silva and Julie Dawson. And they spent a lot of time looking at the pollinator benefits, which was great. But we're seeing yield decreases for some crops. So in yesterday's talk, they pointed out that cabbage is one that has seen less yield decrease. If we have some of our vining winter squash that are able to put down adventitious roots, there's some real benefits there that they're competing better in a living mulch system. But the discussion has really moved through the work of others having living pathways or living alleys. There are very, very few examples of a pure living mulch, you know, just planting straight into that cover crop and having that work. I know there was one that was cited yesterday where they basically scalp that cover crop and then plant transplants into it, and that's enough to set the clover back that the farmer in that situation felt comfortable with yield versus cover crop performance, but that's not always the case. There's a lot of questions, so UW is looking at this, NDSU has looked at this. How wide does that bare strip or that strip that's mulched with something other than cover crops, how wide does that need to be to not have a yield drag? So those were some of the questions we had in mind to look at bringing this work to South Dakota. So again, I want to acknowledge that a lot of people are working on answering these questions, and we're trying to get a larger body of work. All right, so our trial, and again, this was just year one of two, so things could look a little different this next year, but our trial, we had research sites in Brookings, South Dakota on the eastern side of the state. And then we moved to southeast South Dakota, and that's Beersford. And we did work with a grower cooperator in the middle of South Dakota, and are hoping to get more work in the western half of the state as this project continues to grow. I want to acknowledge that our Brookings site prior to this last summer was an agronomic field that has been in a corn, soybean, small grain rotation. So we are transitioning that to specialty crop production. At this point, we had one input that would not have been eligible for to keep us on the track for organic transition. And because of the land use and the research plots going on right around me on the Brookings campus, it's probably going to be a few years before I can transition a portion of that land to organic. So I just want to acknowledge that and be very transparent. Fortunately, at our Beersford site, they already had some organic row crop land certified. And based on land use and everything that's going around there, that is actively in transition to organic production. And if you want to learn more about that trial site, I would invite you sometime over the lunch hour to zip on down to the Organic Research Forum and check out our poster on squash. And I don't know that Alexis will be there, but feel free to check out the poster, and there's a QR code to the report on that. All right, so our questions. Oh, interesting. This did not translate well from Google Slides. That's okay, folks. I apologize. The text should be very neat and tidy, and we're going to see how the rest of the slides look. All right, so the clovers we used were red clover. We used a white Bicura clover cross, which is fairly unique. We hadn't seen that in a lot of studies, and then a white clover. Now, the red clover, that has a taproot that tends to be a taller plant, and that's, we consider that a biennial or a short-lived perennial. The white clover, people have used that a lot in living mulch trials. It stays lower growing. It's a pretty robust-ish perennial, depending on your moisture conditions, and that one spreads by stolon. So you have that above-ground spread, that rooting in along the stem. Something that makes Cura, the white Bicura cross, unique is you actually have the underground rhizome. So that is how that clover is spreading versus spreading over the top. So we thought that might look a little different in terms of weed suppression. And we had a partnership, Go Seed. They're based in Oregon. They were already doing work at our southern SDSU research farm. And so we worked with them on the seed for this. And then we had bare ground conditions. So our research question was how to manage the living mulch. So not only what clover should we be using, but in-row management strategies should we adopt? So we had no fabric with tillage, and that tillage strip was accomplished with a BCS walk-behind tiller. We had a 30-inch wide tillage strip. We had no fabric, no tillage. And I apologize because the boxes have gotten knocked out of whack, but option number two was the true living mulch where we had the no fabric, no till, so we were planting right into that cover crop. The third option was landscape fabric plus tillage, and again, this was that heavy-duty woven black landscape fabric that you should be able to reuse for multiple years, so still an element of a petroleum-based product, still have plastic, but at least we're not throwing it in the dumpster at the end of every single season. And then landscape fabric with no tillage. So putting that landscape fabric right over that clover, pinning it down, trying to stretch it tight, but again, removing that tillage aspect because we were interested both in the effects of the fabric and tilled versus no-till. And then how did three different cash crops perform? Again, the overall picture of the study. So we had bell peppers and broccoli at our campus research site, and then we had acorn squash in southern South Dakota, and we're not going to talk about peppers or squash today unless you really want to at the end. Okay. I like to call out just a few of the tools we used as we decided things like planting rate and how to plant. And if folks haven't used this tool, it is wonderful. It is one of my favorite things. It's the Midwest Cover Crops Council, and this is a consortium of researchers. You know, I would say the majority of the cover crop research is based on thinking about agronomic cropping systems, but they consolidate data across the Midwest. And if I get phone calls for people, what cover crop should I put on my specialty crop farm? When should I plant it? Or what should I use in my home garden? I don't care if you're a home garden or if you're doing 10 to 20 acres of vegetables. The the fact of, you know, where you live and the planting dates, that's not really going to change. So you can go in, do your state, do your county, talk about your goals, and you hit like select or pick cover crops. There's a big button, and it generates this awesome chart based on historic environmental data for where you live and based on research that's been conducted with these cover crops in the Midwest. It generates those planting windows. Again, green is good. You should feel fairly confident in a normal year, whatever that means anymore. Seeding those cover crops at that time to have reliable establishment. Whenever we're using cover crops in our farm, I know like just in our research field, we're doing a subset of all the management and marketing and everything that you're worried about. But even us at the end of the year, we're like, oh, cover crops, that's the last thing on our mind. Like, we just want to be done with the season. But if you can be intentional with whatever cover crops you're using on your farm, how you seed them, ensuring germination success, do you maybe need to add some fertilizer or have, you know, that compost input, or, you know, where are you putting these cover crops in your rotation? Long story short, think of your cover crop as a cash crop, because then you're going to be getting that the most value. Just again, I've been in the same shoes where it's the end of the season, we're just going to do this thing and quick rake some clover in, and it's about to rain, and gosh, I hope this works. And in that case, it did. It looked great. But I've also had a lot of failures that way. So if you're going to, cover crop seed can be really cheap. If it's oats, for example, it can be pretty cheap. Clover is not always very cheap. So you've paid the money for the seed. Think about, you know, those management steps. And I want to point out that you can click on all of those cover crop names on the left-hand side, and it gives you recommended planting rates, recommended planting methods. It talks more about, you know, how do we terminate this cover crop? Is it a perennial? Is it an annual? Cold tolerance, et cetera, et cetera. So there's just a lot of great information on there. Oh, neat. I am really rocking this presentation, gang. There we go. All right, so all of that to say, great tools for cover crop planting decisions. A lot of the research with living mulch has looked at broadcasting the seed, and it's looked at pretty high planting rates, 20 to 30 to higher pounds per acre. Now, working both with our seed supplier and looking at the SARE cover crop research guide, looking, I did nerdy things like did the seed count, seed per pound, because not all cover crops are created equally. So sometimes when we're doing these seeding rates of planting X pounds per acre, that looks really different between a white bicura cross, a white clover, or a red clover. So that's one thing to think about. So we boiled all of that down so that we would have an apples-to-apples comparison of plants per square foot in a perfect ideal world, if the seeds germinated as they were supposed to, of 75 plants per square foot for both the white and the white bicura cross, because again, they had similar habits. Red clover is a bigger plant, so we were trying to get, you know, a reduced planting density, and again, that aligned with the recommendations for the planting rate. So those were our target planting rates in green. Our actual planting rates are boxed in purple because every piece of equipment, if you're calibrating a seed drill, it's really hard to get that perfect. These are real, you know, real farm systems. And we also did use an oat nurse crop because we did spring planting dates, and we thought that you know, having that jump of having a grass and a mix with the clover would be helpful. Again, based on prior research, farm experience, things of that nature. We did use a seed drill at both of our sites. For folks who, you know, whether you have a small seed drill or you're broadcasting, seed to soil contact is really, really important. We went with a seed drill so we could get better seed to soil contact and try to create a somewhat ideal condition. Also in South Dakota, because we're a large agronomic state, there are opportunities for some of our farmers. They might have an agronomic operation, already have a seed drill on hand, or there might be chances for, can you plant half an acre of cover crops for me? You know, some of the equipment sharing with neighbors. And the way we calibrated those seed drills is we took a few of those drop tubes and put plastic bags and drove a known distance, looked at how much seed was dropped in that baggie, weighed, went, okay, we do not have it closed up. I mean, we barely had those seed drill drop chutes. I'm probably not using the right term, but we barely had those chutes open by the time we got our calibration dialed in, because clover is teeny, teeny, tiny seed, as you can see in the box, or for those of you who have dealt with it. So, getting that calibration dialed in was another tricky spot. So, going into the season, our general expectation was, okay, early planting dates. Cover crops are not going to be competitive with those early spring weeds. If we've got perennials emerging or some of those early spring annuals, weeds are probably going to get the jump. But can we get a switch point where that those clover cover crops and those oats start to overtake the weeds, those weeds go down, and we have a successful living mulch? So just hang on to that graphic. The data that we collected, Alexis and our undergraduate team spent a lot of time collecting clover, oat, and weed count and biomass data. We use a tool called a quadrat, which is a fancy word for a square made out of PVC, to collect that data, and that gives us an apples-to-apples comparison of, you know, how we throw that randomly out into the field and get an idea of what's the weed density and the clover density. We spent time timing different activities. How long did it weed? How long did it take to weed these different management styles? How long did it take to cultivate? How long did it take to till, install fabric? How long did it take to plant cash crops? It goes a lot faster to plant a cash crop in a tilled strip that has fabric where you can just go down the row versus a no-till strip, especially with those no-till clovers where you're troweling and trying to get those plants in. So definitely some labor considerations there. We looked at crop health. SPAD is an indirect measurement of chlorophyll content. It can also be kind of a nutrient indicator. We did do some tissue sampling for some of our crops. Overall crop canopy, so getting to that point Natalie made about vegetative growth early in the season, understanding how these crops were doing. And then, of course, the bottom line of what were the impacts on yield. So this is what it looked like as we were implementing those practices. We used a flail mower to knock down that oat nurse crop plus the clovers. And then we ended up doing two tillage passes because we were trying to get to a depth of about 4 inches. This soil, again, conventionally managed agronomic field. There's been a lot of spraying, a lot of different management passes. Some conventional tillage historically. It was pretty compacted, and rainfall events weren't always in our favor, so we had kind of basically dry, compacted, brick-like soil for a lot of the season. Especially when it came time, we did a fall broccoli planting. Getting that tiller into the ground in July, this was for our pepper planting, just so you can see what it looked like. But trying to do tillage passes in July in really dry soil, we ended up actually irrigating the field so that we could even get that tiller in the ground. I'm seeing some nods. I think many of us dealt with that this year. We did pre-burned woven ground cover for our landscape fabric, so we used wooden templates, and this was something we did early in the season before we could get out into the field. I don't know about the rest of you, but in Brookings, South Dakota, May was a bit of a roller coaster for us. It was really cold and wet, then we had a derecho, then it was kind of cold and wet and rainy again, then our team got COVID, so we were a little late in a lot of our activities, but we spent a lot of time burning landscape fabric. So this is an overview of field activities. So cover crops were planted April 26th in Brookings. That was later than I would have liked, but we saw soil temperatures starting to increase, and then they tanked. And with organic management systems, we're not dealing with seed treatment. So if you put seed in cold ground, it's not going to germinate quickly. and you're risking having it rot. So we were waiting for soil temperatures to be 50 and increasing consistently, and we weren't seeing that until the end of April. It took a few days to get all of these plots into place with the mowing and the tilling, and what that did is it gave us about a three-day lag between when cover crops were mowed and tilled into the soil from planting. And again, this was green residue, and we had a decent amount of biomass at this point in the season. And prior to, you know, preparing this field for broccoli planting, there had been several mowing events to knock down that clover, knock down weeds, keep things from going to seed, and we mostly had annual weeds in this field. Broccoli planting was July 18th, and we selected Imperial broccoli. That was after looking at year one of Natalie's trial results and picking one that looked promising for fall production in Brookings, South Dakota. And that planting date maybe could have been pushed back a week or so, but we were trying to play it safe, which I think worked in our favor this year. And we were fertigating. We didn't do any incorporated fertilizer because half of the plots were tilled and half of them weren't. And so we would have had some of the fertilizer lower in the profile and not had an apples-to-apples comparison of fertility. So everything was fertigated, watered the same. And I want to note for organic production that the 10-4-3 would not be an allowed input. Nature's Source does make a 3-1-1 that's OMRI approved, so make sure if you're interested in learning more about that fertilizer, I'm happy to visit with you about it, but make sure you talk to your certifier on that one. And we had two broccoli harvest events, September and October. We had a fairly hard frost, but that last week of September that completely killed our peppers, they were done. And so we did our clean pass harvest October 3rd just to get things wrapped up for the study. Here's an overview of the plot. So you can see those bare ground plots, plants looking beautiful, green healthy, the colors aren't translating quite as well. And you can see the clover living mulch plots in the back, not a lot of weeds poking up. This was just prior to a field tour. Things had been cleaned up pretty well. We were doing hand cultivation passes to maintain bare ground because yours truly messed up the width between rows just enough that we couldn't do a shallow tillage pass with the BCS, so that's something we're going to adjust next year. So this was a lot of stirrup hoes, but again, that shallow cultivation kind of helped prevent future flushes of weeds. And that clover was mowed three times during the season of broccoli production, and we were trying to knock that down to 4-inch height. Again, trying to give enough clover biomass so that you were photosynthesizing, still suppressing weeds, but knocking down any annual seed heads before we could set seed. Based on discussion from yesterday and some things we've talked about this season, we're hoping to do a few more mowing events. We were trying to collect weed and clover biomass tied to every single mowing event, which is a lot of work. It's a lot of paper bags and sampling. And we're thinking this year we'll do more mowing passes and collect that weed data every other time to make it a little bit more manageable. So this is what the broccoli looked like. Next to this would have been one of the white clover, the white Bicura clover plots. And again, you can see we still were having to manage weeds by hand, either with stirrup hoe and or pulling to keep those clean strips. That clover does start to encroach. Who dealt with grasshoppers this year? Anyone? Okay. All right, so it was a literal plague of grasshoppers in South Dakota. I'm glad it didn't reach the rest of you. I'm very happy for you. We had hot, dry conditions as small grains and other things were drying up and, you know, coming out of the fields. It was like a literal plague of locusts. So we did row cover. It was also mostly in our case for the deer because we had a very small fence to keep out jackrabbits and we wanted to keep the deer out of the broccoli. The ground pins were a terrible idea. We are going to use sandbags going forward. We could not get the pins in the ground because it was too dry, too compacted, and then we tore row cover. It was just a whole thing. So we weren't very successful in keeping the grasshoppers out, but we did keep the deer at bay. So just like people starting a farm, I have been a dumb, naive researcher the past two summers, and we've learned a lot of things too. Yes, Jana.
Something really interesting this year, we have a big field.
field, and we had all our winter squash kind of in a section, and we had a set of broccoli right next to our winter squash. The set before that got completely devoured by the grasshoppers.
Okay.
And the stuff that was right next to our fall squash, it was like they ignored it. They all went into the squash planting, which by that point didn't really affect our squash because we had all our squash set on there and mostly had fairly hardened shells. But it was like, how come they're leaving this broccoli alone when they completely destroyed the other stuff?
So. Okay, interesting. So the fall broccoli that was next to the winter squash, they went to the winter squash. Okay. Well, and we have cut flower trials, and I kind of sacrificed my zinnias this year and almost ended up using them as a banker planting. We had minimal grasshopper damage on the peppers. It was mostly the broccoli, but then again, it was about sacrificing the zinnias. I did a lot of stripping of leaves and the flowers still looked decent. All right, so where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. Alexis did a really nice job of cataloging the weeds that we saw, and I tried to color code. So purple is our annual weeds, green being the perennials, and we did have one biennial, that was the salsify. And again, these are two of four sampling dates that we would have had. So some things that we saw, you know, early on, you could see that red clover was taller than the white and the cura, not unexpected. Plant biomass, so anything that has the same lowercase letter behind it is not different statistically, just to help people understand that. So for that first clover sampling, red clover did have higher biomass than the white clover, but the white and the cura would have been similar. And there was no difference in the volume of weeds based on being a bare ground plot or a clover plot. By fall, so October, this was after the broccoli had been harvested, so this was kind of our end of season sampling. We can see that that clover biomass had increased. Something interesting is at that point, red clover had a lower biomass than our white or our cura. So again, assuming, you know, more spread, especially with the stolons for the white clover, could be one reason that we were seeing this response, because red is taproot, and you're relying just on the bushiness of the plant, so to speak. And again, mowing could have an impact on this. You'll see overall that weeds, there was a lower weed density, but I can't say anything about it statistically compared to July to October. We didn't analyze it that way for this presentation. But overall, the weed volume was pretty low. This was really promising going over into winter so that we were, hopefully decreasing our weed problems. So we, at this point, we sampled. We left those fields to go to winter, so we had all of that cover to protect from fall rains and spring rains if we get them. I'm a little bitter about the drought conditions that continue to oscillate in South Dakota, so we're going to remain optimistic. But that's what it looked like in terms of weed and clover biomass. And we had two broccoli harvest events. So this is from harvest one of two. And again, we were looking for nice, well-formed heads, nice tight beading, not bolting. And here's a snapshot of our harvest data. We had the most bolting in the bare ground plots. That was a harvest timing thing on our part. We should have gotten out there. It was like, okay, heads are forming, things look good. And then we went out the next week to check, and it was like classes and field day, and like, holy cow, look at all this beautiful broccoli. And then we realized some of those florets, they were starting to open, and some of them were starting to bolt. So this way you can still see we essentially got all of the heads of broccoli from those bare ground plots. The cura clover, red clover, or white clover, and that's KC, the RC, and the white WC, no difference between the clover used in terms of yield response for year one, and we were pretty conservative in our statistical analysis. And you can see some general trends that tilled with fabric looks like it's trending towards less of a yield loss compared to the other treatments, but from a statistical analysis perspective for 1 year, there was enough variability between plots that I can't say, yes, tilled fabric is going to protect you from yield losses. We're going to have a second year of data that we can hopefully say that. But the tilled strip without fabric, those yield decreases were pretty surprising. So again, our goal was, can we have living alleys, living pathways, and guard from yield loss? And it didn't look really promising for year one. Broccoli was pretty sensitive to those yield losses. And just a note for that expectation of cover crops surpassing weeds over time, that was the general trend we observed at our specialty crop field. It was not the case at our southeast farm because they sat in a D2 to D3 drought for most of the season. And you can hear more about that for our squash if you check out our squash poster. So a lot of lessons learned. I tried to rank them from negative to, we're going to keep looking. So the tillage strips and or fabric did not protect against yield losses. Broccoli yield was reduced in all of the cover crop plots. Now again, as we think about some of those long-term agronomic benefits, soil health benefits, there might be a tipping point on your farm where it's going to make sense. I would love to put broccolini in these plots going forward and look at the yield opportunities for living mulch or living pathways and how that could be improved or how we could guard against some of those yield losses. And we're really interested on what are the long-term soil health, agronomic, and economic impacts. So we are going to have a longer study at that farm that's in organic transition in southeast South Dakota. We're going to be looking at 5 years out. So we're going to have a cucurbit, brassica, sweet corn rotation in those fields. And I'm working with soil scientists. We have started the study samples, and we're going to be looking at 4, 5, 6 years down the road. What are the soil improvements or lack thereof from these different management methods? So again, we've just barely scratched the surface with this work, but would love, I realize we're running down in time because we had some awesome discussion in the middle, which was our goal. But I'd be happy to take a few questions. And while I've got you, if anyone does grow in a high tunnel and would want to fill out a 10-minute high tunnel survey, the QR code should work. But I'm working with colleagues both in South Dakota and at North Dakota State. We're trying to understand more of what are your high tunnel challenges. And there were some questions that came up today about high tunnels, so I'd love to hear your feedback, and feel free to share that with your friends. Questions, thoughts? How many people have tried a living mulch in any form? Okay, a couple of folks. How many people have tried an accidental living mulch, aka it's just gone to weeds and we need to knock them down with a mower? Me too. our farmer collaborator, that was one of the reasons she wanted to try the living mulch, was she's like, well, things just get out of hand and weedy anyways. We might as well try to put something intentional in there. That was the farm in the middle of South Dakota, and first cranes came in and ate a bunch of the seed after it was planted. Then we got the trial planted and they got hailed out, and then we got the trial replanted, and then there was extreme drought, and by August all of the clover had died. So I think one of the things we're going to be thinking about is clover might not be the best option for South Dakota with our lower rainfall conditions, and we're thinking about things like TEF that Iowa State has worked with and some other more drought tolerant options. But it's also going to be a balance of drought tolerance, and are you out competing the cash crops? So something to think about. And Dylan made a great point yesterday in the tillage reduction presentation about mowing that clover more frequently, because you, in theory, that clover is going to be sloughing off more roots and you're going to have decreased root reach, so you might not have as much water and nutrient competition. So I think there's some really cool questions that we could ask about that as well. So any questions, thoughts? I probably turned everyone off from cover crops. That wasn't my goal. I think our takeaway with, you know, trying new types of broccoli or broccolini or trying cover crops, start small, try to have side-by-side comparisons, or, you know, we're always looking for research collaborators, whether it's the University of Minnesota or myself or studies, which can be really helpful. So don't bet the farm on anything you saw today, but bet a small portion of the farm and then adopt and adjust.
This is helpful because I feel like we've been thinking about
Awesome. Well, thank you for that feedback on this being helpful of should we do it? Yeah, I will say for year one, the amount of yield decrease, regardless of the management strip that we used, was disappointing. But again, that's, I think to Natalie's point about why we try silly things like spreading disease or, you know, different management methods is, thank you, taxpayers, for giving us some money to try crazy things so that you can focus on what's going to work for your farm and be economically feasible and environmentally sustainable.